Trying to think of a nice, neat segue into what I was going to be talking about. I could probably pick about a dozen, so I'll just launch off into it. Yeah, I work in Office Environment and Heritage. Apologies to all of my colleagues that I didn't actually have access to the new template, so I just bodged one up myself, same as always. I guess today I wanted to touch on some of the policy issues. I mean, when I sit and listen to the presentations like Pete's just given, and residing as I do now in the conservation policy and strategy section within OEH, I inevitably start thinking, okay, what does this actually mean for policy? And what does it actually mean in terms of getting things done on the ground? So high-level policy and also getting things done on the ground and how we actually transition or allow policy to ensure that it facilitates and enables action on ground. So I'm going to talk a little bit today about some of the big picture or high-level policy mechanisms that help to drive implementation and delivery within New South Wales. And I'm going to then start and drill into the Great Eastern Ranges Initiative as an example of how we've tackled some of those challenges of getting response to the big picture issues translated into action on ground. I'll try and leave as long as I can for questions at the end, but if I start going too fast, then just tell me to slow down. Okay, in terms of the four major areas of policy activity that I want to touch on today, obviously, we're going to start with the highest level, the aspirational level, the state NRM condition targets. We'll drill through into the draft New South Wales biodiversity strategy, talk a little bit about some of the adaptation response work that's going on within DEC, and also then start to really get into thinking about investment in cross-tenure whole of landscape approaches and what that can actually mean in terms of the new challenges for information. In the first instance, the NRM condition targets. Do we have anyone from the NRC here today? I think we do. Okay, I can say what I like about these. Only nice things. The NRM condition targets were established several years ago now. They've been in place. They really provide this highest level strategic overview of basically, how are we going to try and achieve sustainable, ecologically resilient landscapes across the state? The 13 targets focus on land, water, biodiversity and communities. So there's a recognition of the interaction between biophysical and human dimensions in natural resource management. The reason why I flashed this one up as a starting point is that the NRM condition targets really do strongly influence probably the major NRM delivery mechanism within New South Wales, which is the catchment management authorities and particularly the targets that they set for implementation at the catchment scale. And also the Natural Resource Commission established the standard for quality NRM, which is basically a process model by which CMAs are required to work through and translate the state level targets into action commitments and priorities on the ground. So it's pretty influential in terms of the day-to-day reality of what actually happens on the ground in NRM and those really critical mechanisms, the catchment action plans, for being able to understand, absorb and translate understanding about climate impacts into what we actually do on a day-to-day basis. So while the condition targets provide that high-level aspirational framework, the actual strategic framework for what we're going to do and identifying what's important, what's significant, and where should we actually invest within the state is taken up by the New South Wales Biodiversity Strategy. The first state strategy was developed and released in 1999. So here we are, 11 years down the track. We're more than overdue for a refresh. Late last year, the former department released a draft biodiversity strategy for public exhibition. It really starts to highlight five key areas of activity, one of which I'll be drilling into in more detail in terms of whole of landscape planning, but also improved partnerships. One of the major innovations that the strategy does is it proposes a series of priority areas, areas that are priority for an investment in improving native vegetation management to try and enhance ecological resilience and enhance the sustainability of species populations at state scale. It's based on an analysis done by Michael Drelsma and his colleagues up in Armidale. Looked at a whole series of criteria I won't go into, but essentially it's the first attempt at the state policy level to try and identify spatially explicit priorities which within their analysis has actually been embedded considerations around how do we actually ensure resilience and try and maximise ability to adapt to climate change impacts. The strategy itself refers to the next level down in terms of implementation. And the framework that's actually been adopted by the former department again, but obviously still relevant to the OEH days. Basically, back in 2000, anthropogenic climate change was listed as a key threatening process under the Threatened Species Conservation Act. One of the things that the department's done in response to that is actually start to get a better handle on or start to prioritise its own internal actions, its own internal efforts, and start to put some rigour around the various activities and programs that it delivers to try and respond. So it basically sets out a bit of a blueprint for the key priority activities that the department will undertake and that it would obviously encourage collaboration with other organisations on around things like science and research, getting a better understanding of what are some of the key information and knowledge gaps at the state scale. It talks about priority areas, how they sit and how they fit into a broader implementation framework. And it goes right the way through to talking about the types of education activities. Now, both the state biodiversity strategy, the draft state biodiversity strategy, and that climate change statement of intent talk about implementing whole of landscape approaches. Now, those of you that know me for a few years would be aware that I've been involved in the Great Eastern Range Initiative for about the last 3 or 4 years now. It's one of a series of continental scale connectivity conservation initiatives that have emerged worldwide. There are several in Australia. It's largely a recognition of the need to act at a much broader scale, but also to bring together the range of different delivery organisations that are involved in conservation and natural resource management, get them working in concert across large distances to start to get a better outcome, a more integrated outcome at the scale of the issues that we're working on. Great Eastern Ranges Initiative itself, it's used to be the Alps to Atherton, but it's been extended notionally out to the Grampians in Victoria. It now stretches approximately, or notionally, 3,400 kilometres from the Grampians right the way through to far north Queensland. As an initiative, it's responding to a whole series of really key high-level issues, all of which are relevant, obviously, as well at the New South Wales state policy scale. In terms of the scale of operation, it's a response to the recognition that ecological processes happen at a range of scales, from the global through the continental down to on the ground, providing some kind of understanding of what's happening at the broader continental scale is a really important context for the decisions that get made. Particularly when we think in terms of the level of promotion and understanding of broader growing community conversation around climate change, obviously as well as the recognition that there's a high level of social distress around climate change issues, individuals often feel disempowered when it comes to thinking in terms of what can I actually do to address this major process and problem that's happening on a much broader scale than I can ever seek to address myself. So it provides, as much as anything, a social coordinating framework, a broad social enterprise that individuals can actually engage with and can undertake and can find that they at least can contribute something that they can see has a connection to a broader outcome. Obviously, as well, recognition that protected areas alone are not going to be sufficient. The traditional scales of action, whether it be at local government scale or at regional catchment scale, likewise are going to be inadequate if undertaken in isolation. That doesn't mean they're not important. It just means that there is another broader scale of consideration that's required. And I guess the response or the recognition of all of these types of issues have really stimulated or led to that broad investment in large landscape or continental scale initiatives worldwide. And we're starting to see within the Australian context, particularly over the last 5 years, a real shift and an acknowledgement and a recognition and an uptake of some of those considerations in policy. So we've got, for example, down in Victoria, prior to the last state election, there was a white paper that was released talking about whole of landscape conservation activities, talking about biolinks. The South Australian government has previously adopted its nature links concept as well. So we're starting to get these things popping up, not just in New South Wales, but more widely. Great Eastern Ranges Initiative then, essentially attempting to establish a continental scale connectivity corridor from Victoria, as I say, through to far north Queensland. What it actually entails in practice is working, or has so far over the last 4 years, working in four priority gaps, five priority gaps in five priority landscapes: Border Ranges, Hunter Valley, Southern Highlands, what we call the Kosciuszko Coast Link, the southeast coast, back up into Kosciuszko National Park, and a transect down the southwest slopes called the Slopes to Summit Link. In each of those landscapes, what we've been doing is bringing together the whole range of cross-sector interests, conservation NGOs, farming groups, research, CMAs, and so on and so forth, bringing them together to really sit down and work out what collectively can be done in that landscape and how their existing intended efforts can be aligned to achieve a much bigger outcome at that local scale, but one which contributes to achieving connectivity outcomes at the broader Great Eastern Ranges scale. In implementing a program like Great Eastern Ranges, what it's done is it's started to force us to really grapple with some of the real chewier issues that I think we'll probably likely be touching on during the course of the day. Obviously, from its early days, Great Eastern Ranges was cast as a resilience approach to addressing climate change, a response to climate change. But it starts to really then, when you promote programs in that way, raise a whole series of questions about, okay, what is resilience? What do we mean by resilience? And at the Great Eastern Ranges scale, what are the entities and the processes that we're managing? Is it a relevant scale at which to be operating? And if so, what are the priorities for activity or for action at that scale? In answering those questions then, really, it starts to give us a bit of an operating framework as well. It helps us to identify not only what it is that we're managing, but to identify priorities for where we work in the future. Obviously, as those five partnership areas were established as pilot areas, we're looking towards expanding, getting things happening, making connections in the other states. So we need a much better understanding of what are the priorities for implementing this type of whole of landscape approach into the future, but also, I guess, revalidating, but also helping to express the relative contribution that existing efforts, whether it be the five partnership areas or other activities happening within the Eastern Ranges, how they contribute towards achieving an outcome on a bigger scale. Okay, so one of the first processes that we were looking at was bird migrations. I'm just going to show you a couple of examples, and that's probably going to stop in a moment. One of the projects that we did just last year was with Birds Australia to actually look at species records and slicing them on a time series basis to understand where species are moving. The whole reason for doing that was to identify, first of all, the relationship between patterns of movement and the range of climate and other variables and habitat variables that might influence, but also to then start and question the data and say, are there particular patterns or landscapes that we're seeing certain patterns of movement? What's the significance of the Eastern Ranges relative to other landscapes for species movements? And are there landscapes that we should be working in the future, or what's the relative importance of the landscapes we're working in now in terms of maintaining or sustaining those species movements? So I'll just show this one again. If it's actually going to kick in again. Yep, flame robin. This is a really good example of an altitudinal migrant. The red crosses indicate where a species is actually being found or occurring at a particular month in the year. And you can see we've got a little time wheel that flips around there, indicating that obviously the species is utilising the high country over the late spring, summer months for breeding. And then as we get into winter, through autumn and winter, species moving back out onto the adjacent slopes, the lower country, where it's residing over winter. Really, really useful little piece of information out of this. First of all, it started to show us the fairly broad patterns of movement that we could see across the landscape. Gave us also an opportunity to really start and communicate to people not only issues about where species are moving through the landscape, i.e. between the low country and the high country, but also telling the story of this particular species that's had a fairly significant decline in populations over the last 20, 30 years or so, largely associated with the loss of, or the degradation of wintering habitat. One of the other things that we were able to find as a result of the work we did as well was we looked at 18 species. Brush cuckoo is another species. This is a really strong latitudinal migrant, a species that spends the bulk of its winter up in Queensland. A fair few old folks that do that. But anyway, it's, again, it gives us an indication as to where species are moving, but also the types of movement patterns that they're displaying, and really starts to highlight when you overlay a series of species like this, the significance of particular landscapes. That Gold Coast hinterland and the western arm of the border ranges up there on the Queensland border has shown up for a whole range of species as two really significant movement pathways. And again, it starts to flag for us that into the future some of those issues associated with urban development in the Gold Coast hinterland are issues that we'll likely need to pay closer attention to. So really allows us to identify where are the species movement pathways, the common movement pathways, but also identifying where are the gaps or the potential bottlenecks in movement, and also identifies what are some of those landscapes where species are not, on the whole, appearing to move through, and what's the reason for that. So it helps us to start and tease out the information a little bit more. But also, because some of the Birds Australia data that we utilised has information about behaviour and also really good quality location data, it allows us to actually slice the data not just on a time series basis, but also thinking in terms of where species are, what they're doing at different times in the year. Also a really useful device for communicating to people the differences in behaviour and habitat use by what they would seem think would be reasonably similar species, but in this case, flame robin at the top and the rose robin at the bottom, showing very different patterns in terms of where they're occurring or what they're doing at particular times of the year within the landscape. And also allows us to then start and say, okay, how is that likely to change? And for example, fitting in with some of the future modelling work and some of the stuff that Pete was talking about, help us interpret what might be the particular impacts on certain species. Really what the bird movement data allows us to do as well is to start thinking in terms of understanding what are the actual drivers behind species movements, why are particular species moving in a certain way, and also then using that to understand or get a better sense of how those driving conditions might change into the future. So this is all just emerging work. Literally, this stuff's coming off of the presses as we speak. But really, in tandem with the work that we did with Birds Australia last year, we also commissioned a series of other projects looking at vegetation condition, current and future condition, looking at species composition, getting a better understanding of the relationship between a range of environmental drivers and species assemblages along the ranges, and also looking at things like primary productivity, time series data, identifying where are the particular areas that are likely to operate as drought refuge into the future. I won't go into any of these flares in detail. That's probably a presentation on each of these individually. Just a flag that really the opportunity now presents itself to be able to start thinking in terms of the things like rainfall seasonality and equating it to species movements in the first instance as a communication device, but also as we then start to bring future climate models into the mix and understand how things like rainfall are likely to change in the future, getting a better sense of how that might potentially impact on species movements. Likewise, species composition, understanding the relationship between weather events or seasonal conditions, which species are flowering or fruiting at particular times of the year, how that's influencing species movements, and likewise, how those types of patterns and interactions might change into the future. Identifying landscapes or areas that have the potential to act as those real repositories for species during periods of climate stress, but also as well getting a better understanding on vegetation condition and how a range of threats applied at a broad landscape scale can impact on vegetation into the future. This particular, just talk about this one for a moment, the darker areas are the areas of vegetation that are in better condition. The library area is obviously poorer condition. What we did was we ran a couple of scenarios looking at what might the landscape look like or what might condition look like in a worst case scenario, say in 20 years' time, if you factor in projections for increasing population density, continued agricultural intensification in certain landscapes, increased urban and rural infrastructure and the like. And it came up with some pretty stark outlines. I mean, as it stands at the moment, you can already pick out, for example, up around the Border Ranges, the Blue Mountains, the Southern Highlands, and obviously the Hunter Valley, some of those landscapes where we've got poorer condition and hence functional connectivity likely to be lower. But when we actually overlaid a scenario into the future, it gave us a pretty stark contrast in terms of what some of the impacts might potentially be. So I'll just show you the back and forth between those. That's current condition and future condition, really, again, highlighting the potential impacts of degradation on connectedness, but also the increased islanding effect that it has on the protected areas network. Now, what that does in sum total is really taking it back to, okay, how do we actually take a big picture view and think in terms of how we translate the big picture into action on the ground. Really, the work that we've been doing highlights the importance of working in the five landscapes that we've been working in, but also highlights the importance of being able to bring together a whole range of data and also bringing together the interpretation that can happen in terms of in the context of a large program like Great Eastern Ranges to inform particular landscapes where one might work into the future and give you a sense or a context for why you might work in those landscapes into the future. And I'm going to do the pull-up short there and open up for questions because I know I've spoken a bit too long.
Thanks.